Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can personally take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal revival, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us, no matter what we find to squabble over. Now, you can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can call us direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if an old-fashioned on-the-air station in your area carries this show, you just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for the show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly or even extra-humanly possible on the station archives. And for information and links from these shows, you can go to offthegridstofreedom.blogspot.com or just email me. Lots is happening, and a lot needs to happen to make freedom for all of us real. And my own blog site is titled How the Neocon Stole Freedom and is conveniently located at howtheneoconstolefreedom.blogspot.com. This week, the story up at the top is a first volley on the career of Phyllis Schlafly, the covert operative recruited by Big Oil who did her job. The title is, what else, Phyllis Schlafly Exposed as a Neocon. Take a look at the graphic. Her well-compensated job was to keep women in the position of second-class citizens under the law. Like I said, this is a first volley on Phyllis. More is on the way in my book, Off the Grids to Freedom, out soon. And now, news from the rumblings of the web. Last night I got 6 emails across my desk that stated flatly that the recent transport of armed nuclear weapons from North Dakota to Louisiana, something that violated all protocols for how such weapons are handled, was not the big news. The big news is that one of those 6 weapons is missing. Now, this is not an illegal transport. The orders were personally signed by George W. Bush in his role as commander-in-chief. There's no reason to believe that George does not know where the missing bomb is. The question that must linger in our minds until it's answered one way or another is what he intends to do with the bomb. Perhaps hide it under his desk in the Oval Office so he can have his own personal weapon of mass destruction? Inquiring minds wait to find out. News from the Ron Paul Revolution. Peggy Noonan, former speechwriter for Ronald Reagan, said this on September 7th about the debate in New Hampshire. Quote, "The debate was full of fireworks about Iraq, about its essentials, the rightness of the endeavor, and what should rightly be done now. From the libertarian Ron Paul, a blunt argument against the war. We never should have gone in, and we should get out. The people who say there'll be a bloodbath are the same ones who said it would be a cakewalk. Why believe them? His foreign policy, mind our own business, bring our troops home, defend our country, defend our borders." After Mr. Paul spoke, it seemed half the room booed, but the other half applauded. When 1,000 Republicans in a room and one man of the 8 on the stage takes a sharply minority viewpoint on a dramatic issue and half the room seems to cheer him, something's going on, and that's what we hear from old Peggy. And Wired magazine reports that the techo geeks are coming out for Ron Paul big time. This from an article that ran today by Sarah Leigh Sterland. As campaign finance records show, and the blogosphere has noted, a substantial base of support for Paul comes from professionals in the technology community. "People in the technology industry tend to be more educated and more intelligent," said Jeffrey Schwartz, a Paul supporter who organized the fundraiser through Meetup. Schwartz is a psychiatrist and longtime libertarian. He said Paul appeals to people who like the politician's message of freedom. Among the Republican candidates, Paul enjoys a unique position on the Internet. His supporters are particularly wired, using Meetup and Eventful to organize events and fundraisers. Supporters expend a lot of energy pumping up his stats on YouTube, Technorati, and online polls. Paul is on a fundraising tour of the West Coast this week. On Thursday, Paul spent the morning and lunch in San Francisco and had plans to meet and greet Silicon Valley supporters in Palo Alto at a $2,000 a head dinner. In total, the campaign expects to net $100,000 from its Thursday fundraising efforts. Matt Nicaro, who brought his 11-year-old son to hear Paul's message of limited government. Nicaro is a technologist from Walnut Creek, California. He's part of a team that develops Verizon Wireless website. Nicaro also described himself as a libertarian who supported Ronald Reagan. He said technologists support Paul because they're detail freaks. When you work in technology, a lot of the time you have to scrutinize details, he said. Sound bites are not enough. Nicaro and others at the breakfast said they did not think of themselves as Republicans or Democrats, that their political affiliations are fluid. What drives them, said Paul supporter Hannah Bernard from Sacramento, is the sense that their candidate is treated unfairly by the media. They're telling us he can't win, she said, but both she and other supporters point to Technorati and YouTube statistics as evidence that Paul's support is wide and deep, even though that hasn't translated into support in traditional polling numbers or campaign finance cash. He's the most searched for human being on Technorati from May this year, apart from Paris Hilton, said Schwartz. Doesn't that tell you something? In that vein, you may have your own Ron Paul email address free. The URLs available are googleronpaul.com and voteforronpaul.com. Here at BBS, Don chose one of each. Linda Hattiecut of Granny Warriors chose, not surprisingly, Granny Warriors. You'll be able to tell your friends by your address what you think about a lot of things. The sites will also have some exciting possibilities, so stay tuned and be looking for the emails. To reserve your own free email address, contact Ticketslayer at googleronpaul.com today. Last week, we had Connie Ruffley with us. Connie, you might remember, is the head of United Republicans of California and was here to talk about two icons of purported conservatism, William Buckley and Ronald Reagan. And we learned how those two men had worked to change the understanding of the term conservative for the profit of big oil. See Off the Grids to Freedom for the lexicon of terms. Big oil is the conglomeration of corporations and individuals who have worked to ensure a security of their own profits at the cost of everything Americans believe and want. You don't need to confuse the issue with the silliness of the Illuminati. It's all about the bucks, as I laid out in my article on Buckley last week. Dr. Jennifer McLeod will be sharing with us her lifetime experiences as an advocate for the rights of women today. Now, how does that relate? Well, to Phyllis Schlafly, well, I think you're going to find out. Now, the doctor was one of the first women to break through the glass ceiling and occupy a position of responsibility and power in corporate America. So she knows some things about Phyllis she might not even have thought about in context. Dr. McLeod is a social psychologist and social activist who received her BA magna cum laude at age 19 from Radcliffe College of Harvard University, and then her MA and PhD from Columbia University. After several years in industrial and advertising research in New York City, she joined Opinion Research Corporation in Princeton, New Jersey, where she rose from survey director to research director to chief psychologist. She was then tapped to be the director of the newly formed Center for the American Woman in Politics at Rutgers University Eagleton Institute. Her tenure lasted only 6 months due to a policy disagreement. Her plans to move strongly and rapidly to conduct high-quality research that would measure the then 1971 exceedingly dismal status of women in politics were not accepted by the Institute's management. Dr. McLeod then opened her consulting firm, Jennifer McLeod Associates. She built a successful consulting practice, developing and providing survey and focus group research and workshops and training programs, much of it for large corporations such as AT&T and Exxon. A significant amount of her work focused on researching and improving opportunities for women and minorities, particularly in employment. In a 3-year break from consulting, she served as vice president and head of human resources for one of her clients, Fidelity Bank in Philadelphia, thus expanding her areas of expertise. She retired from her consulting practice in 2000. Please welcome Dr. Jennifer McLeod. Jennifer, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today to discuss one of my and your least favorite subjects, which is Phyllis Schlafly.
My pleasure.
And we always start with asking our guests to tell us a little bit about themselves. But for you, I want to start with your history with the women's movement. So could you tell us a little bit about that? You have a long history. You've done some very exciting things that I didn't even touch on.
Well, I started in working in the women's movement in 1969. And I realized at that time that much of my experience was sort of leading in that direction, because it was in those days so extraordinarily difficult for women to be autonomous and to move ahead and do what they wanted to do. I was the first president of the first NOW chapter in New Jersey, which got me started, and we were a very active chapter. We worked for the Equal Rights Amendment. We worked for the elimination of sex discrimination in employment, and many, many other areas, health, laws, particularly laws, and changing laws that affected women and helped to keep them down, and discrimination in education. At that time, the discrimination against women in education was very severe. It was very difficult to get advanced degrees and so forth, because the assumption was that a woman would never use her education.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got started, and in working with other women, we made a lot of changes in those years. The changes were, it was about time, and the changes were made. Many changes were made, and women today are benefiting from the work that women did in those very frenetic days in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
The employment discrimination was really quite fierce. They still, help wanted ads were still segregated by sex. So that you open a newspaper and looked at help wanted female or help wanted male.
That's right. And you wouldn't have been able to apply for a job if it was a job in the male column, right?
No. If you tried, no matter how qualified you were, if you telephoned, they'd say, no, that's a man's job. You know, we have secretarial openings, but that's a man's job. No. Or if you went to a corporation, a receptionist, usually female, would say, oh, no, that's a job for a man. Sorry. that sort of thing went on. And it was extremely difficult. It was only a few women who, for whatever reasons in their background, their abilities, their personalities, were willing to buck the overall pervasive discrimination against women in all fields, who were able to begin to make changes.
And that meant, of course, that they oftentimes had to accept a job in the secretarial pool, even if they had a PhD.
Oh, yes, yes. And I, with all my degrees, had to start as a typist and then try to get a typing job in a company where I might somehow be able to work out of it. And it took me about 5 years, even with my magna cum laude Harvard degree, before I could reach even an entry-level college graduate job in my field, which is social research.
Now, what year did you graduate from college?
I graduated in 1949, mm-hmm. and then went ahead and got my master's and PhD. I got my PhD at Columbia in 1958. And meantime, I had married right out of college, and So I graduated from Radcliffe at 19, so I was pretty young, and mm-hmm. that gave me more time to develop and to make some progress toward more of an autonomous life and a real professional career of my own.
And that was the future that really faced all women, no matter how hard they tried. You were, Phyllis Schlafly was born in 1924.
So she's 5 years older than I am. So she's pretty ancient. I'm pretty ancient now. Phyllis is even more so.
Okay, but then the future that she was looking at was pretty much the future that you were looking at that point in time.
And to her credit, she rebelled. Clearly she must have rebelled or she never would have gotten a law degree. It was extremely difficult to get into law schools in those days.
She got the law degree in 72.
Yeah, well, it was still very difficult to get law degrees, for women to get law degrees, because the law schools had really quotas for women, and those quotas were pretty small.
Mm-hmm. But she had already written a book, and the book mm-hmm. that she had written was, A Voice, Not an Echo. And I don't know if you've ever read the book.
I never met Phyllis Schlafly, never wanted to meet her, and I've never read any of her stuff because the little bit that I would read would make me so angry that I'd put it down.
All right, but we're going to go through a kind of little exercise mm-hmm. today. Phyllis Schlafly wrote the book, and it was published in 62. And the content of that book was about how the corporations controlled America.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she had been researching the book for a number of years, and then she wrote the book, and she kind of hung around you'd think of it as the conservative Republican movement for a while. She was a member of the John Birch Society.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time that Buckley eviscerated the John Birch Society by accusing them of being anti-American because they were against the war in Vietnam in 65, she left. And I think it's very important to keep that timeline in mind as we discuss her and mm-hmm. what her motivations might have been as a woman looking at the frustrations that you experienced and wanting to get ahead in the world.
Yeah, she reacted somewhat differently. I did come across just recently a little item about her background that I hadn't shared with you. She did research for Senator Joe McCarthy at the height of the McCarthy era in 1950 to 54, which is interesting.
That is. It would be interesting to see the research today and consider it, considering what we know about the reality of communism now.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, now we know that communism was never really a threat. After the Cold War and it had ended, we realized that they had never had the technology to really be in competition with it, and they had been impoverishing themselves to even try to create the facade.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, here we have Phyllis Schlafly.
Mm-hmm.
And she was looking at a reality, and she became the head of a movement. And you first probably became aware of her name in the 70s.
Yes.
Is that about right?
About then, when she started campaigning against the Equal Rights Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And the very, very, very strange thing for a woman of some accomplishment to do, to work against a needed constitutional amendment that would make it easier for other women to move up.
Mm-hmm. And what was your personal reaction when you first encountered her and saw the impact that she was having on, you know, what you knew was going to impact not just even your generation of women, but other generations mm-hmm. of women?
Well, it, of course, was anger. And in those days, in the early 70s, there was a lot of anger among women. There were two branches of the women's movement, essentially, that actually did come together. One branch was the sort of educated, highly educated upper middle class, which was where I was, and the other branch was working class women who may not have gotten college degrees and were seeing all the difficulties from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And the two wings of the women's movement, of course, as one would expect, sort of squabbled between the two, but did come together because there was a recognition that, look, the sexism and the stereotyping and the discrimination takes many, many different forms, but we all shared
mm-hmm.
the same, very much the same kind of situation. The manifestations would be different, but the basic situation of women as second-class citizens and second-class citizenship being constantly enforced by cultural and legal means, and keeping half of the population from having autonomy to decide for themselves what they wanted to do with their own lives.
Mm-hmm. And that's really what it was. If without access to the workplace and being able to hold a job and bring home an income that was enough to support your children, what happened is that you were dependent, and that was a position that women didn't want to be in.
Well, that had been the position of women throughout recorded history, and one of the points that I always like to make is that, of course, we were very angry about this, but an understanding of how that all came about and the way it came about in practically every community and every civilization around the world was the same, basically the same. But in primitive society, in order for a family, a clan, or a community, a tribe to survive, perhaps the most difficult thing that they had to do was to reproduce themselves and raise a new generation of people,
mm-hmm.
of human beings. And those societies that did not focus on that didn't survive. So that this became built into the whole structure of society, that women had to be kept in their roles as baby makers and baby raisers, child raisers, and working to around the home base in order for that group to survive. So it was not a gigantic conspiracy by men over women. It was very simply a survival mechanism that without which a group of humans would not survive to the next generation. And it, so that it got built in not only into the psyche and the society from the male point of view, but also from the female point of view, that they also, in order to, for their group, their family, their descendants to survive, this is what they had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that pattern lasted for tens of thousands of years through history. And we found ourselves at the first part of the 20th century just moving to a point where the survival necessities shifted, where it had always been necessary for families to have many children because so many of them died before reaching adulthood, that suddenly the earth was getting overpopulated and the opposite became necessary.
Mm-hmm.
So that we have been, for the last 150 years or so, certainly in an incredible revolution that has brought about the emergence from that pattern of half the population, actually a little more than half the population. And so when you look at it that way, try to look at it in that perspective, that you can understand how we got to where we were in in my lifetime, in the 1970s, when I got involved in the women's movement, where we were still stuck with all the stereotyping and the customs and the mechanisms by which the subordination of women was enforced,
mm-hmm.
to making changes.
And, of course, a lot of changes were made then, but it was a very, it was a thing that had been going on, I would suggest,
oh, yes.
for a long time.
Yes.
If you
mm-hmm.
take a look at, and we know a lot about the economy in colonial America,
mm-hmm.
and women were a significant part of the economy. And
oh, yeah.
It was typically on a household basis. There were two internal economies,
mm-hmm.
what the husband did and what the wife did. Very frequently, the woman was separately accounting for and caring, taking care of her trade,
mm-hmm.
which was separate from her husband's.
Yes.
Especially in New England, marriage was on a contract basis. It was not considered impossible to have a divorce. There were conditions under which a divorce was accepted and perfectly reasonable. And certainly violence was one of those conditions. A lot
mm-hmm.
of the things now actually where, you know, women are still constrained or judged were conditions in colonial America where they were able to get a divorce in the New England colonies.
Mm-hmm. And all of the conditions under which people lived and groups survived shifted over time, and then depending on place, depending on conditions, and so that changes were taking place, but very often when conditions change to, say, more of a what we would call a towns and rather than just a series of farms in the wilderness, then often it went back to the more ancient, more restricted role for the women. So it's a fascinating, the history is utterly fascinating and often overlooked. People think of history as a bunch of wars and presidents and generals and invasions and kings and queens and so forth, when much more interesting and profound things were happening on a different scale.
Wouldn't you say it's pretty much exactly like it is today? If you open People magazine, it's about the people of glamour. But the real interest, the real human story is in the ordinary people.
Yes.
And how they lived their lives and how they were making changes under much more difficult circumstances, usually, than were confronting the people of prosperity, shall we say, in any culture.
Mm-hmm.
So here you have, so let's for a moment get back to what women were facing in the late 60s and early 70s. They were coming out mm-hmm. of a period where they had been struggling to actually finally establish their rights to things like controlling their own paycheck if they were married.
Yes.
They were looking at actually being able to hold different kinds of jobs that they hadn't been able to hold, and those jobs,
mm-hmm.
I think, were almost all better paid.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking at the idea of equity in marriage so that they didn't have to follow the orders and demands of their husband.
Yeah. Well,
that,
of course,
that institution could be on the basis of persuasion.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. The whole idea that there was no such thing as marital rape, that after marriage it was considered completely legal for a husband to rape his wife, and that was of course a carryover from, well, the wives were owned by their husbands. They were property. And of course in the 30s and even into the 40s, a woman who did earn money, the paycheck would go to the husband rather than to her.
Mm-hmm.
And women who wanted to have their own businesses could not obtain leases or loans without the signature of a husband or a father, could not get credit, could not get bank credit, and where I really continued to be identified by their marital status.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 70s, a woman had to identify herself as Miss or Mrs. And in fact, we found that out one time when the New York Times wanted. We had a sit-in at a lunch place in Princeton, New Jersey, where they wouldn't allow women in at lunchtime. And we had a New York Times reporter along with us as we had a successful sit-in. But he refused to talk to any woman in the sit-in who refused to identify herself as Miss or Mrs.
Mm-hmm.
Would not even talk to us because he said, "Look, I can't quote you in the article unless every woman has to be a Miss or a Mrs.
Or she doesn't exist in his world."
That, in other words, a woman's identity was a man's identity. Either she was her father's daughter, unmarried, or she was her husband's wife, and would then became Mrs. John Smith.
And that had a real impact on your life, didn't it?
Oh, yes. Well, here's a little secret. When I was working for my PhD at Columbia, and it was a tough go because I was working full-time trying to write my doctorate, and Columbia was not always very hospitable to women graduate students. But one thing that goaded me on was that I had discovered, I'd already been in the workforce, I already discovered that as long as I was Mrs., let alone Miss, as long as I was Mrs., that I would be defined only in that sense. So, of course, what I wanted was a doctor title. And when in my low...
To get
moments,
out of the ghetto, right?
Yeah. Well, in my low moments, why am I doing this? I think every PhD student has moments like that. I said, I'm doing it because I want to be me, and I do not want to be defined by my relationship with my father or my husband.
Mm-hmm.
So it was for me a particularly sharp kind of a form that it took for me. It was part of my story, and of course all the women at that time, each one has fascinating stories to tell.
About when they confronted that issue and did something about it.
Well, and they did something or tried to do something, and of course some failed in trying because we were punished. Well, there were many ways in which we were punished for being so uppity as to insist on not being humiliated and not being treated in the old-fashioned ways. So there was a lot of punishment, and of course the pay scales were still still really disgraceful, no matter where we were in the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
Typically about in parallel jobs, completely side by side, office to office, desk to desk, it was 60% or less than what the male.
And yeah, I've heard people try to make the argument that this was because, well, women leave and they don't stay, and yada yada yada, and they're not as reliable in the workforce. But that's not the truth.
It's not the truth. Although, of course, many women did finally give up. Because what would happen is if a woman was married and her husband was doing reasonably well, the taxation, the income tax was such that it was always assumed that the woman's salary was sort of in addition to the man's.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, at those times the income tax rates were pretty high. So, say he made $40,000 and she made $20,000, the 20 would be taxed at the top rate. And, of course, if she had children or she had to use services because she wasn't home full-time, many times the couple would look at it and say, "Look, you're working like hell. but it's not bringing in any extra money.
Mm-hmm.
So many women did leave the workforce because of that, which is completely understandable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, they could probably have been, made more at home, so to speak, then.
Well, it just wasn't worth the hassle because the gain in income in comparison to expenses was so small, and sometimes even it was an actual loss.
Mm-hmm.
So it really took a very strong effort to get around that. But in fact, as time has told, that women are in often cases been a lot more reliable and stay in their jobs longer, and certainly don't switch jobs as often because they didn't have the opportunities presented to switch.
Mm-hmm.
When the men were moving up through the corporation, the women weren't moving up, so they weren't switching from company to company to get to better opportunities because there weren't any.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very complex equation that each woman had to solve that equation herself and make decisions accordingly.
Mm-hmm. So when you take a look at what Phyllis Schlafly chose to do, which is essentially knowing exactly where the power was, because we can see that mm-hmm. she knew exactly what was actually going on in American culture, she chose to, take a position where she could use her services to persuade women that they wanted to and needed, for reasons that were presented as things that would frighten them.
Yes.
And destabilize their world, to remain in a
yes.
subservient position.
Yes, and clearly it was profitable to her in many ways, and so of course you could understand why she was so strongly disliked, because she was a traitor, considered a traitor to the cause, and she really was a traitor to the cause, because you have. You had a woman who could have used her talents to help change things for the better for all women, and of course not only for all women but for all families and for the society as a whole, but who chose to do the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Because it was more profitable to her personally.
Presumably that's why. I can't think of any other reason why.
Yes, and if you take a look at what she must have known because of what she had done intellectually and
mm-hmm.
what she had written and what she had had access to and what she had professed in public in her own written works, you can't really reasonably come to any other conclusion.
That's right. You know, there were many women who made compromises. For instance, there were very bright and able women who just decided their best bet was to find themselves a wealthy man to support them in the style to which they would like to be accustomed. And they did so fully eyes open and knowing or finding out what it was they had to pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
And there were many, many little examples. For instance, I remember a friend of mine who went that way and had all kinds of money and several houses and, cars and servants and so on and so forth. And she, too, had graduated from Radcliffe. And at that time, Radcliffe was still raising its own money. But she never gave a penny to Radcliffe.
Mm-hmm.
But she and her husband gave thousands of dollars every year to her husband's college. And,
mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the compromises that they made many times with their eyes open or found out sooner or later. They could buy themselves diamonds or mink coats, but they couldn't give a penny to their own college.
Mm-hmm.
This or to anything that would help things for other women. They had to be, keep that away.
But you'd have to say that Phyllis's choice was extremely different. Her husband
yes.
was wealthy.
Yes.
She never, you know, was never there, stuck at home taking care of her own children.
Mm-hmm.
And what she did was she decided that she was going to do well for herself on top of having
yeah.
married.
Yeah.
And I have no qualms with her having married. If she just decided to marry and have kids, that would have been a natural, normal thing to do
mm-hmm.
that anybody would have understood. But to on top of that, I mean, her husband could have guaranteed the well-being of her and her children,
mm-hmm.
and she would never have been in want. But she went beyond that, didn't she?
Yes.
She decided yeah. that she was going to use her intellectual talents to persuade women to move back in time so
mm-hmm.
that they and their children and other women and their children would not have the same choices that she had had.
Yes.
And in so doing, arguably, if you took a look at it case by case, which is something we don't normally do, there are women who had continued to be subjected to violence of different kinds.
Mm-hmm.
They, I'm sure that there were, because the laws, the same people who were fighting the ERA were fighting the baby ERAs in the States.
Yes.
And there were women who were left between a rock and a hard place, who had no place to go,
mm-hmm.
Had no alternatives. She watched, and she's justified, as the legal system has been used against women, and
mm-hmm.
she has continued to vilify feminists
yes.
as
yes.
completely self-serving in a way that, if you look at the language, I suggest to you that in some level she understands that she's talking to herself, and that was really her that did that. I think there's a tremendous amount of projection in her talk.
She probably knows exactly what she has been doing. She must surely know that many of the arguments, that the scare tactics that she used were phony from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. And those included things like unisex bathrooms?
Yes, the horror of unisex bathrooms.
Oh, my God. And, of course, what a woman would ever want a unisex bathroom? Why would we put up with it?
you know, the fear of women being in the military, where you take the stereotyped vision of what a woman was supposed to be and put her then in imagination, put her in arm-to-arm, hand-to-hand combat with knives and guns in trenches as in World War One, you know, that sort of thing. And of course, women were horrified. Well, I was always horrified by hand-to-hand combat, but I have a son and a daughter, both, and I wouldn't want that for either one of them. Fortunately, they were of a generation that didn't face that.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that it's okay for your son, but not okay for your daughter, to have those kinds of experiences is pretty horrible to think about.
And one of the other things that I noticed as I was going over many of her articles was, you know, the continuation of, it was a rant, you couldn't really call it anything else, about how unsuitable women were for this and how unsuitable
yes.
women were
yes.
for that. And she lumped women together just in a way that you'd have to think of as being, if it was over a color, you'd say it was racist. Because
mm-hmm. yes.
there are women I know, I haven't known a lot of women like this, but I went to school with a woman once who, if she had wanted to be a firefighter, I would have had no compunction.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know she could have carried me out of a burning building.
And
she
of course,
was 6'2".
There are an awful lot of men who couldn't.
And I've known lots of men who couldn't have done that. And there are objective criteria like upper body strength, and that's perfectly reasonable and rational to take a look at any job on the basis
yes.
of all the objective criteria.
Yes, and this was one of the things that we were working on so very hard through in those days, and it still continues, where they say, well, we can't allow women to do this and that because they're not suited for it. As you say, well, what you can have, every job can have, if they are truly objective requirements for the job in terms of education, experience, physical ability, or whatever, and you test for those, and if somebody can't pass it, if it's truly required for the job, then they don't get the job.
And that's, of course, something that you as a feminist are never supposed to say, right?
You know, there were that women are suited to be nurses, but men aren't, and it's just not in their capacity. Or, you know, the idea that still continued and still sometimes pops up that, women have smaller brains and they just don't have the brain power.
Oh, no, you forget also we have uteruses and it makes us hysterical.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, there was an attorney general back in the 50s or early 60s, and I can't remember, I block on his name, an attorney general of the United States who announced that, well, women could never hold really high elective office because of their raging hormonal imbalance once every month. Raging hormonal imbalance. And, of course, when that happened, that was terrific for the women's movement because it was so utterly outrageous that that a lot of women signed up for the women's movement on the basis of that.
Well, brace yourself. I've heard that many times since, and I've heard it this decade about my raging hormones, and it's like, what? Because I have to tell you, everybody may have some sort of a cycle there, but I see a lot more cycle in men. And they don't even want to do research there. They don't want to hear about it.
No. Well, and I remember that one reaction to that, somebody did a study, because they were saying raise your hormonal imbalance, you know, women will press the button to send an attack or do something outrageous like that or violent. And they compared, of course, the rates of violence among men, no matter what time of the month it was so much greater than the violence or the weird behavior or the outrageous behavior of women
and
in
this
the
is
throes of their periods or premenstrual tension.
And, you know, you've touched on something that there is a tremendous mythology still being perpetuated today. If you go and you ask somebody in the quote-unquote men's movement, they will tell you with a straight face, despite all of the objective evidence, mm-hmm. that women are as violent as men are.
Mm-hmm.
Honest to God, they will tell you that. The first time a man said that to me, it was one of those, I was dumbfounded, because it's always 10 to 1.
Uh-huh.
Men are 10 times as likely to be violent as women are.
Yeah, and that's part of it. It undoubtedly resulted from evolution and what was required for humans to survive in the early primitive societies. It's just, that's just the way it is. And,
absolutely. it is the way it is. And the fact is that they want to say that women have raging hormones, but we have, you know, we go through a cycle of hormones, you know, and testosterone is by far the more powerful impactor of behavior.
Yes.
Than any female hormone could be.
Yes. Oh, but you're looking at it objectively.
Oh, I know, and that's
Belinda.
Wrong with me.
That's a no-no.
I know.
But the kinds of arguments that Phyllis and her ilk would spout would be, well, you can't have women managers over men because the men would be, in effect, emasculated by reporting to a woman. That women can't, women and men cannot compete directly in anything because, and this happened, I was an expert witness in a court case of a young high school girl who wanted to join the tennis team, the high school tennis team, in order to get an athletic scholarship, which she desperately needed. And they took her to court, and the arguments were they had a male psychologist come in and say that you absolutely cannot have women, boys and girls competing in tennis because of the extraordinary damage to a teenage boy if he gets beaten by a girl. And that in a way encapsulates the whole thing.
I agree.
It really is. And I was sitting there in the courtroom when the judge swallowed that, and the girl lost her case. It would be damaging to the delicate psyche of a teenage boy to be beaten at tennis
and
by a girl.
They're actually trying to recycle that kind of argument again now. And
yes.
Over and over you see that where they want special privileges wherever they can figure a way to get them. You take a look at what they've done with the whole family law system. They've turned it into a war against women and against their children. And they make money in ways that no decent human being, it just makes you blanch. And one of the most prominent cases right now, and I can't say that in some ways I have a lot of sympathy for her, but you can see where the whole thing is going, and it's because she has the money, is with Britney Spears.
I haven't been following Britney.
She has two small children. She married that boob. She never should have married him. His girlfriend was pregnant with a baby when they got married, or had just given birth. He doesn't pay much attention to those, but he wants to stay home and quote unquote be the dad to her kids while she works. It's truly amazing. And when you take a look at women like Phyllis Schlafly and you see it in this context, it just truly makes you wonder what the content of their consciences could possibly be.
The society is a lot of sexism a lot of improvement has been made, but you open up the newspaper today and you see all the ads and every woman has to be, they all look alike. They're made to look alike by Botox and dyes and push-up bras and all of these things. There's only one way that a woman is supposed to look. And you'd open up the newspaper and you'd think, well, an alien from Mars would look at that and what conclusions they would draw about this strange human race.
Yes. Well, they can certainly see what men find sexually attractive. That hits you in a moment.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I'm not finished with Phyllis.
I think
this is going to be a very interesting period because, I'll have to tell you, I'm very pleased about the fact that I was talking to some people who have been active in the John Birch Society, and they agreed with me. Let's think about how the world could change, huh? That could be exciting.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us today and for helping me sort of put Phyllis through the ringer just a little bit. And I'm hoping that you'll come back again and talk to us some more about your experiences, because I know we barely touched on them.
Well, thank you, Melinda. I enjoyed our conversation.
And you take care, and you have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Good night. And that's our show for today, Friday, September 14th, 2007. You know, we need the truth. If we owe each other nothing else, we owe that to everyone. That's a message that says, I love you. We're connected. I see you. We're one in the sacred. Many of us see that as the sacred presence in Jesus, but it doesn't really matter. Never sweat the small stuff. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. And you know it's meant for all of us, men and women. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Thanks, Thomas Jefferson. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom.